Questions?
All of them?
Everything?
Yep. We start over like chapter two?
Why not from chapter one? Pop quiz?
No.
Pop quiz?
No.
That's not the pop quiz.
Is this really happening?
Yeah. Are you kidding?
No, it's not really happening.
Oh, is it?
Nope.
Quiz fine. I would have just died.
I realize, so centripetal acceleration, I think, is both confusing and we haven't had a quiz on it. But obviously, I wasn't going to give you a pop quiz, so I just gave you this ungraded quiz. You can do with this piece of paper whatever you want. I'm never going to see it again, so. Gives you an idea of what kind of a typical centripetal problem might be.
Are we having a quiz on this on Friday?
No, we're having a quiz on what we're talking about today on Friday. So, I don't know, maybe I picked the wrong day for the quiz. So, the problem involves a turntable, which is something that we used to play records on, and these things would spin, and the problem says that this coin is just barely sticking to the surface of the turntable at 45 RPMs and 10 centimeters. And you're supposed to, most importantly, write down a free body diagram and calculate things up. So from a top view, we have something that kind of looks like that. And a side view, here's our coin that's sitting on the table. Yes?
Is that the easiest one to draw a free body diagram for this one, like the one on the right? Or do you necessarily have to have both of them?
So this one is... I think I like this one better, except that I think that the geometry maybe isn't quite so clear. That's why I drew both of them. The reason this one is good is because we're going to have a normal force and a gravitational force, and it's hard to draw them on that diagram. So we know that the normal force is going to go up and gravity is going to go down, but it looks pretty funny on this sort of thing. What's good for this is to remind you that the acceleration has to be centripetal, pointing towards the center, which means that the frictional force, which is causing that acceleration, must be going that way too. So the frictional force is pushing it to the center. Forces that start with C don't exist, so there aren't on this diagram. I don't know. That's all I'm going to say about it, since it's a quiz. Uncollected, take home. I'm never going to see those pieces of paper again.
Are we going to go over it, though?
If you ask me to.
Can we go over it?
Well, I've started it here, right? So as this thing spins faster and faster and faster, this acceleration is going to get more and more and more, and eventually we reach the point where the frictional force, which is less than or equal to the static coefficient of friction times the normal force, is going to be saturated. So at this just barely hanging on situation, the frictional force is equal to the static coefficient of friction times the normal force, and that has to equal the mass times the acceleration, which I can write as v squared over r, or I can write as omega squared r. It kind of doesn't matter. I'll choose the latter just to be a little bit different. Pretty clearly, the normal force has to be canceling the force of gravity. So our final equation is going to be the static coefficient of friction, mg, is m omega squared r. You can see that the m's cancel out, so it doesn't matter whether this is a penny or a nickel or whatever. The static coefficient of friction is going to be omega squared r times g. So what's left is a unit conversion. Right, so in this problem, I think it's 45 RPMs. I forget. Yes, no? I don't have a copy with me. What does it say?
45.
So 45 revolutions per minute. And we know that there are, in 1 minute, there are 60 seconds. And one revolution is 360 degrees, which is 2 pi radians. So When I do unit conversion, I'm going to end up with omega in radians per second, which is what I have to have if I use this formula. So I've got 45 divided by 60 times 2 times pi, and I get 4.7 radians per second. So I'm going to plug that in here. 10 centimeters is 0.1 meters. We're using MKS units. So G is meters per second squared. We might as well check units here just to be safe. So here we have radians per second squared times meters divided by meters per second squared. And you can see that the meters go away and the second squared go away. And we have radians squared, but radians are unitless. Radians don't have any units. So what we're going to get out, the static coefficient of friction, better be and is unitless. So I get 0.227. Yes? So I could have used either one.
Okay.
If I were going to use the velocity, it's a little bit trickier because somehow or other these 45 revolutions per minute correspond to a velocity. And what I would say if I were going to do it the other way, basically as kind of a unit conversion sort of idea, in one revolution, there are 2 pi r meters. And of course, then we have the other conversion for 1 minute is 60 seconds, and the radius is 0.1. So if I crank that out, I get a speed that is 60 divided by 2 times it, pi times it, 0.1 times it. I get a velocity that is, looks a lot like omega, but it's not, right? This is meters per second. And I could plug that in here. So to me, the omega revolutions per minute is basically the same thing as omega, whereas velocity is a little bit different, but 6 1/2 dozen of another. So if you're more comfortable with Latin letters as opposed to Greek letters, you can use V. More questions?
Was the radius given? I'm just missing it, or did you?
It says that it barely holds on 10 centimeters. I think it does. I don't have it in front of me.
It does.
Going, going, gone. So, in some sense, we didn't add a lot to our list of stuff because we've had these equations for a while for the force of gravity at noticeable distance from the center of the Earth. We did put them to use to calculate the orbital speed and the escape speed. The orbital speed is how fast you have to be going sideways in order not to hit the Earth. And we have this kind of funny idea that what orbiting is falling 100% of the time. But not hitting, basically, because the Earth is curved. So the escape velocity turns out to be just square root of 2 times the orbit velocity. So usually, it's not that much more difficult to escape from a planet as it is just to orbit. Historically, Kepler's laws of motions of the planets were important because they were one example where friction wasn't particularly present, and so we could see whether or not Newton's laws were satisfied. And Newton could show that just using his force of gravity, he could reproduce these laws of motion that Kepler had discovered by looking at the motion of particularly Mars. So Kepler's three laws are that the orbits of planets are ellipses, they're not circles. So they have near points and far points. An ellipse is basically a squashed circle, and the amount of the squashness is called the eccentricity. So zero eccentricity would be a circle. Eccentricity of one would be a line. There's this kind of complicated area law that Kepler discovered, which turns out to be the same thing as r squared times omega is a constant. If we look at different planets and relate what their year is to their distance from the sun, it turns out that t squared over the semi-major axis cubed is a constant. And that constant can be related to the mass of the thing that they're orbiting and Newton's gravitational constant. Capital G. More questions? So in the next chapter, we're spending a lot of time looking at this sort of situation where we have something that is designed not to move, right? So something like a bridge that is designed to be static. And we know, of course, if it's going to be static, the sum of the forces are going to be zero. But we also don't want it to twist. So we have a new equation that says the sum of the twisting forces also have to be zero. So we need a name for twisting forces, and torque is the one that's existed. So if you look at automobile engines, for example, you also often see the engine rated in terms of its maximum torque. Well, what's required to twist something? Well, this thing is called a torque wrench, so its purpose is to twist in bolts. And very commonly, you don't want to twist the bolt too hard or too loose. And I'm not sure you can see, but I can read how hard I'm pushing by this scale reading. And this is an English wrench, so its units are foot-pounds. And I can try and twist this bolt hard by applying a force. If I apply a force this way, I achieve absolutely nothing, right? No twisting occurs. So the only way I can actually twist it is by applying a perpendicular force. And the other thing I'm sure you recognize is that I was pushing pretty hard in order to get that torque, but I can do a lot better if I just have a bigger arm, right? So with almost no force at all, I can achieve the same sort of twisting force. So this twisting force doesn't just depend on the force. It depends on the orientation of the force, and it depends on where that force is applied. So in general, if this is the thing we're trying to twist, and we're going to apply the force at that spot there, it turns out we can say that the torque, usually denoted by the Greek letter tau, is equal to the perpendicular piece of the force, right? Because the other piece of the force does absolutely nothing. So it's equal to the perpendicular piece of the force times the radius that it's being applied. If you want, we can rewrite this perpendicular piece of the force in terms of the sine of the angle. This angle here, for example. So we could also write this as the force times r times the sine of the angle. Incidentally, it doesn't matter which angle you get. It turns out that the sine of both of those angles is the same. So you can kind of take your money and pick your choice. There's another way of defining torque which maybe seems a little bit funny, but it's useful. We can talk about the line of action of the force, and we can talk about the perpendicular distance to that line of action. So it turns out that it doesn't matter where we apply that force, any place along that line, it would have the same effect. So this perpendicular distance, sometimes called the moment arm or the lever arm, is another way we can calculate the torque. So all of those are exactly the same formula. We can take the perpendicular piece of the force times the radius, we can take the perpendicular radius times the force, or we can take the magnitude of the force times the distance times the sine of the angle. They all give exactly the same answer. Okay, so the new rule we have is if it's not going to twist, the sum of the torques have to be zero. And of course, we've known for a long time that if we add up the forces in the x direction, if it's not going to move, then the sum of the forces in the x and the y direction better be zero. So these are going to be our three equations for statics, for keeping things not moving. Now there's one kind of problem that, I don't know, it isn't immediately apparent. How do we deal with objects like this? Every atom of this rod is being pulled down by the force of gravity. And so it's going to take us a long time to add up 6 times 10 to the 23rd forces that all have different distances from the radius. And it turns out there's a great simplification that's called the center of gravity or the center of mass that says that there is one location in an extended object that you can treat as if it were a point mass. So we can think of something like this rod as being the same as a point mass that has a distance from the rotation point. And we can then simplify our calculations. Okay, so the center of gravity, it's also called the center of mass. That's this magical point for which we can treat the extended object as if it were a point mass. So this is the location that is equivalent to having a point mass there as opposed to an extended object. So in simple situations, there are calculations, formulas we can have for finding the center of gravity. So for example, if we know the location of every piece of an object, if we add up the mass times the location of all of those pieces, all n pieces of them, and divide by the total mass, that'll give us the location of the center of gravity or the center of mass.
And that's what's considered the point mass.
Yeah, so that point, the location, this location gives us the equivalent point mass for an extended object.
What is a point mass?
So a point mass is a point that's a mass. So it's the opposite of an extended object. It's an extended object has extension. A point mass just has location. All of the mass is at a spot. So it's nothing physical, but approximately, for example, a nucleus is a good, pretty small object that has mass.
So it's a point.
It's not literally a point, because it still has some extension. It's about 10 to the minus 15th meters in size. Yeah, point mass has zero mass. A mathematical point, has no extension.
But you're just pretending that that's where all the, like that point is where all the mass is.
Exactly. So there isn't literally so the center of gravity isn't a literal object. You can't get a bottle of center of masses. But it's a mathematical equivalence that we can treat this whole object as if it were a point that was at that spot.
Okay.
I think you'll see it working in a second. It's usually pretty easy to find. So for example, if I wanted to find the center of mass of this thing, it would be pretty hard, right? I'd have to break this up into all bits and pieces, like this little tooth, and add up the location of those pieces times the mass and divide by the whole mass. But if this thing were a point mass, if I support it, the point mass would lie right below wherever I'm supporting it. So it must be that the center of mass of this object is right below where I'm holding it now, someplace along that line. And it must be that the center of mass is someplace directly below where I'm supporting it now. So those two lines only intersect at one point. So without doing any calculation, I can figure out the point that is equivalent to this complicated object. And usually you know where that sort of point is, right? So you know that the balance point of this meter stick is going to be at about 50 centimeters, more or less. So the center of mass must be about here.
And does that relate then to the torque equation?
You'll see how that relates in a second.
Okay.
But yeah, we're going to use it in the torque equation.
Okay.
So here we have this little kind of bird that's being supported by its beak. So it must be that the center of mass is someplace right there below the beak. Right, because that's the thing that sits right below the support point. And so the center of mass doesn't have to be in the object. It can be outside of the object.
Is the center of mass part of that equation?
So this is the location of the center of mass.
Oh.
Okay, so here's, I've got an inclined plane. But some things seem to go up the inclined plane. So what's happening here? Well, it must be that the center of mass is going down, right? That's the only way the center of mass can go. So you notice because of these tilted sides, the center of mass is going to be pretty high here, and it's going to be lower there. So the center of mass is actually going downhill. And of course, the center of mass is right in the center of this symmetric object. Whereas this guy here, since it's a circle, the center of mass always has the same altitude above the bottom. Okay? So if something sits like that, the only way that's possible is if the center of mass is above the support points. Right? So I can, so if I'm careful, I can support that pencil on that side because the support point is relatively big. But it's a lot harder to get the center of mass directly above the smaller support point. So it's a lot harder to balance that pencil on its point. So here we have a couple of cases, and it must be that the center of mass of these things is right above the support points, right? It must be there. Otherwise, these things would tip over. Okay.
They're just sitting on the
table. Yeah, they're not glued.
And what's happening?
So the only way that something will sit stably is if the center of mass is directly above the support. So it must, there's relatively small support here. Must be that the center of mass is someplace in that region.
Okay.
Has to be directly above the support points. Okay, so we can find roughly where the center of mass is by playing the kind of teeter-totter game. Right, the center of mass must be someplace about there for this object. Right, so for a uniform object, the center of mass is, of course, right in the center. This isn't a uniform object. It's weighted. Okay. So what does this have to do with torques? If we look at this sort of situation, we have obvious forces here and here, but this beam weighs something. And I can calculate the torque of gravity on this beam by just using the center of mass of this beam, as opposed to adding up every bit that's inside of this beam. So I can treat an extended object as if it were a point. And then it's a lot easier to calculate the corresponding torque. Okay, so forces are required to move the center of mass. If there's no external force, then the center of mass won't move. I shouldn't say that, because it could move at a constant velocity, right? But whatever velocity it has at the beginning, it's going to have that same velocity at the end. Yeah, let's take a look at some examples. Okay, so this is the example that we don't want to have, right? You want to have things balanced with the mule having its feet on the ground. That's, generally speaking, not a good situation. So let's take a look at that situation. So if you've ever moved stuff to your apartment upstairs, you might think about these two guys carrying this pipe. Who has to do more lifting, the bottom guy or the top guy? So if this is a uniform pipe, then the center of mass should be right between these two. And if I choose that as my twisting origin, then if this distance is the same as that distance, then the teeter-totter tells you that those two forces have to be the same. But if you've ever carried things up, right, it doesn't seem that way. So if we think about carrying a mattress upstairs, now the center of gravity is right in the center of this mattress, and you can see that this moment arm is a lot shorter than that moment arm. So in order to have equilibrium, this guy has to be pushing a lot harder. Okay, so here's the center of gravity. And what forces are acting on that mattress? Well, F1 is pushing it up, F2 is pushing it up, and of course its weight can all be thought of at the center of gravity, it's pushing it down. So I can choose my origin any place I want, but the sum of the torque should be zero. So I'm going to choose my origin to be at the center of mass. So that means that the torque of this force, which is of course this distance times this moment arm, has to be the same as this force times that moment arm. Right? Because that's what the twisting force is. It's the perpendicular distance times the corresponding force. So this guy is trying to twist it clockwise. This guy is trying to twist it counterclockwise. If there's going to be no net twist, then D1 times F1 has to equal D2 times F2. And since this distance is short, this force has to be big in order to make up for it. So the guy at the bottom has to provide a bigger force if we're moving a mattress, but he doesn't have to provide a bigger force if you're carrying a pipe.
What do you mean by twisting force?
Torque. Exactly the same thing as torque.
Okay.
So one thing that's a little bit funny about that term is I talk about the torque, but the torque depends on what origin you choose. If I choose a different origin, I'm going to get a different number for the torque. So maybe there isn't the torque the way there is the force, because it depends on something, namely the choice of origin. Well, we'll see. I did here. You're going to choose the origin to be as simple as possible. You're guaranteed to be able to choose it any place you want. So for example, I could have chosen my origin here, in which case this force is twice as far away as the weight, and so it has to have half of the weight. So I get the same conclusion, right? If I use this as my origin, then this weight is closer, this weight is further, so it's a wheelbarrow effect, class 2 lever sort of effect. So this guy has to be less than half of the weight.
So the first distance is shorter or longer than the second?
So you can say this distance is small compared to that distance.
And that means what?
That means they have to multiply together to give the same thing. So if this is small, this has to be big to make up for it.
Oh.
The torques have to be equal and opposite. If it's not twisting. Okay, questions? Well, let's take a look at some problems. So, let's start with this guy, 21. So here we have a guy that's being supported on a uniform plank. The plank is 2 meters long. So remember, we can treat it as if it were all its mass were concentrated at its center. They tell us how much it weighs, they tell us how much the guy weighs, and they tell us the location of the guy, and we're supposed to figure out what all of these forces are, given that it's a static situation, so that the sum of the forces and the sum of the torques have to be zero. So let's kind of redraw. That diagram. So here's my uniform plank. I've got a tension that is pulling that way at 40 degrees. And I've got something that is supporting and something that's pulling this way that are labeled, I guess F2 is up and T3 is that way. And of course, I have the guy who weighs something located at some distance d, and I can treat the extended object as if it were all at its center of mass, and it weighs 30 kilograms, and its distance from this side at least is 1 meter, because it's a 2 meter plank. And I think this guy is half a meter from that side too. Okay, so some of the forces have to be zero, some of the torques have to be zero. When we talk about the torques, we have to choose an origin. Okay, so let's deal with the forces first. We use the usual coordinate system. The only forces that are in the x direction are T3, which is actually in the minus x direction, and this piece of tension. That piece of tension, since it's a side that's adjacent to the angle theta, that's going to be T cosine of, well, 40 degrees. So that's a positive force, T1 cosine of 40 degrees. T3 is a negative direction. The sum of the forces in the x direction have to be zero. In the vertical direction, we've got some weight, he weighs 700 newtons. And we've got T2 and a piece of T1, which is also supporting. So T2 is in the positive y direction. The other weights are in the negative y direction. And this piece of T1, which since it's a side opposite the 40 degrees, we're talking sine, is in the positive y direction. Some of the forces in the y direction have to be zero. So I don't know, it's looking maybe somewhat good, but notice that we've got three unknowns in two equations. So that's not enough. We need to calculate the sum of the torques and set it equal to zero. And when we talk about that, we need to figure out what origin we're going to use. Doesn't matter, you can choose the origin any place you want. You will get the same answer in the end. But the equation you write down will be different depending upon what choice of origin you make. And you want to choose it in general to be as simple as possible. So if I chose the origin here, for example, there'd be a torque of gravity, there'd be another torque of gravity, there'd be a torque due to T2. T3 wouldn't be doing anything in terms of twisting. So there'd just be one unknown. That's a pretty good deal. Another choice would be to choose this as an origin. So none of these guys would have any torques because they're operating at zero radius. There'd be a torque of gravity, a torque of gravity, and there'd be a torque due to T1. Another possible choice would be to choose that as the origin. In that case, T3 wouldn't have a torque, but this one would have a torque, this one would have a torque, and that one would have a torque. So the formula for torque is R times F times the sine of the angle between those two, or if you want, R perpendicular F or R F perpendicular. So when I say has no torque, what I'm really saying is the torque is zero. In that case, because the radius is zero. When I choose this as my origin, then that's a big value for r, but the sine of the angle is zero. Or if you want, the moment arm is zero. Or if you want, the perpendicular component of the force is zero. Okay. Well, so what origin do you want to pick?
The first one.
Which was the first one? This one?
Yeah.
So if we choose this as our origin, then no torque. This is going to try and twist it in the counterclockwise direction, which oddly enough we usually call positive. This guy is trying to twist it in the counterclockwise direction. This guy isn't going to cause any twist. T2 is going to be trying to twist it in the opposite direction. Usually we call that a negative torque. So if we write down all of these equations, so here's our origin. The torque of gravity is at a distance of 1 meter from that origin. The force and the radius are nicely perpendicular, and it's in what we're going to call the positive direction. So that's a torque that is the force, 30 g, times the radius. This guy is at a distance that is 1.5 meters, because this was 0.5 meter, and he weighs 700 newtons. It's nicely perpendicular to the radius vector. So, and it's in the counterclockwise direction, so I'm going to call that plus. So I've got 700 times 3/2. T2, nicely perpendicular and 2 meters away, but it's pushing in the opposite direction. So it's minus T2 times 2. So the sum of those torques have to be equal to zero. And that's kind of a nice choice because it immediately gives us, pretty immediately gives us, we can calculate T2 then by 30 times 9.8 plus 700 times 1.5, all divided by 2. So I don't have to have multiple equations and multiple unknowns. So I've got 30 times 9.8. And I've got 1.5 times 700, all divided by 2, and I get 672. Yep, that's what I got before. Okay, so if I know T2, I can calculate T1 from that equation. So if I do that, then what I'm going to get is T2 minus 700 minus 30 times G. Plus T1 times the sine of 40 degrees is equal to 0. T1 is what I'm interested in, so I better isolate it. So I get T1 times the sine of 40 degrees is equal to plus 700 plus 30 times g minus T2. So T1 is equal to 700 plus 30 g minus T2 all over the sine of 40 degrees. So I got T2 that's sitting here. So I've got 30 times g. And I want to add 700 to that. And then I want to subtract T2 from that. And then divide that all by the sine of 40. And I get nearly exactly 500, but actually 501 newtons. And once I've got T1, I could calculate T3. Now, just for fun, let's choose that as our origin. And we'll see. We better get the same. All the equations will be different, but we better get the same answer at the end. It's kind of funny. Everything's different except the final boxed answer. So if I choose this as my origin, then I'm going to have this guy's weight. Before that was a a counterclockwise torque. Now it's a clockwise torque. So the sign of that torque has changed, right? Because it's trying to twist it clockwise direction. So that's now going to be minus that weight times its moment arm. This guy here is also trying to twist it in the clockwise direction. So I'm going to call that 30 times g times 1 meter.
How do you know if it's clockwise?
Well, just look at it, right? So if you push that way, and this is your origin, it's trying to go that way, right? We're good. There is kind of a more complicated rule, I can't remember if it's in the book, that has to do with what's called the right-hand rule. Well, let me say it once, we'll maybe never use it again. So what we want to do is to put the two vectors r and f at a common location and think about pushing the first vector r into f. And then your thumb, if it points into the page, it's a negative torque. And if it points out of the page, it's a positive torque. I think looking at it is usually way better. So if we want to figure out whether it's a positive or negative torque for, say, this force of gravity, using this as our origin, what we do is put those two vectors. So this was the force vector, and that was the radius vector. Put them at a common origin, and then think about pushing the r vector into the f vector with your fingers. And then your thumb points in the direction of the torque, which is positive if it's out of the page, and it's negative if it's into the page. Yeah. So it's not a matter of what the force is trying to do, it's a matter of you are taking the r vector and pushing it into the f vector. I'm not pushing it take a look and see which way it's twisting it. Okay, so this guy is trying to twist it clockwise. This guy around this origin is trying to twist it clockwise. This guy is trying to twist it counterclockwise. So it's going to be a positive torque. So that's going to be plus T1 times the sine of 40 degrees times the 2 meters. And those things all had to add up to zero. So what I'm going to get then is that T1 is equal to all of this negative stuff on the other side of the equation. So 700 times a half plus 30 times 9.8 times 1 meter, all divided by the sine of 40 degrees. Okay, so it's a totally different equation from this one, but it better give me exactly the same answer. So I've got 700 times 0.5 and 30 times 9.8. Add it to it, and then the sine of 40 degrees divided by it.
I think the 2 needs to come down.
Yes, thank you. And now, yes, it's going to give me the same number I got before. newtons. Well, we could make, and probably will, work more problems like this, but I want to show you this kind of different problem that also involves center of mass. So this is an experience that if you've ever been in a boat, you know that when you push off against the boat in order to walk forward, there are equal and opposite forces. So if the boat is pushing you forward, you're pushing the boat backwards. So when this guy walks forward, the boat is going to move backwards because of this action-reaction result. There are no external forces here because we're assuming that there's very little water friction. So the center of mass has to be in the same location. So these guys can move around all they want, but the center of mass is going to be exactly where it was at the start. So here we have a kind of a different sort of problem. With no external forces, the center of mass isn't going to move. And so we can say that if we add up the masses times the positions, that's the center of mass initially. That has to equal the center of mass finally. And of course, the mass is the same, so mostly what I need to do is add up the masses times the position before and after. And see if they're the same or not. So in this particular problem, I'm going to use my origin to be the end of the dock. And where is the center of mass of the boat initially? Well, it takes 3 meters to get to the end of the boat and 2 meters to get to the center of mass of the boat. We're assuming that it's in the center of the boat. So the mass of the boat is 70 kilograms. That's a pretty heavy boat. So we've got 70 kilograms times 3 plus 2 is 5 meters. And the kid is starting out 3 meters from the dock, and he weighs 40 kilograms. So we've got plus 40 kilograms times 3 meters. That has to equal the center of mass location in the end. So in the end, here's the dock, here's the boat. So let me call the unknown distance that the boat is from the dock x. The kid is someplace out here. Yes?
Where did this 5 come from?
This 5? So that's the location of the center of mass of the boat. So we're assuming that the center of mass is right in the center of the boat. So it's 3 meters to get to the end and then another 2 to get to the center of mass.
And the initial is like when he's on the dock, we're saying?
Well, he's not on the dock. If you read the problem, he's starting here at this end of the boat.
Okay, so
and he's going to walk forward towards the front of the boat and try and pick up this turtle, which is 7 meters from the dock.
So then why do we need the three plus the 2 to get the 5?
Because that's the location of the center of mass of the canoe, the boat, right? It's here. So he is 3 meters, and the canoe's average position, its center of mass position, is at 5. And what's going to happen, of course, is the canoe is going to move in, so it's going to end up at less than 5, and he's going to end up 2 meters beyond that. So the kid, the 40 kilograms, we've just said is going to be x plus 4, whereas the 70 kilograms, the boat, is going to be x plus 2, right? Because it's the extra 2 meters from the end of the boat to the center of mass of the boat. So this is one equation and one unknown for x, so we should be able to solve for it. So if we expand out all these parentheses, we're going to get 70 times x plus 70 times 2 plus 40 times x plus 40 times 4. And we can bring all of those constants over to the other side of the equation. Let's do it up higher. So we're going to have the original position, that's 70 times 5 plus 40 times 3. Minus this stuff, 70 times 2 minus 40 times 4. And all of that has to equal the 70x plus 40x, which is 110x. So in the end, we've got the 70 times 5 plus the 40 times 3 minus the 70 times 2 and the 40 times 4 all over 110. So 7 times 5 is 350. Here we've got 120. Here we've got 140. And here we've got 160. So we got 350, 120, plus, and we're supposed to subtract 140, and subtract 160, and then divide everything by 110. So x is equal to 1.55 meters. So the kid, 4 meters on, is 5.55 meters. And the turtle is still where it was before, at 7 meters. Right, so the boat has moved in basically 1.5 meters as he's moved out. And unfortunately, the turtle is now beyond his reach. Right? It says, assume that he can reach about a meter. So he could pick up the turtle if it was at 6.5, but it's at 7.
So, so it has nothing to do with friction?
So we're assuming no frictional force. So if there are no forces, then the center of mass can't move. So wherever it was initially, it has to be finally. Rearrange as you want the deck chairs, the center of mass is going to be at the same spot.
So if the boat's out there and he's on one end and the hand of God picks him up and puts him on the other side, the boat will move back that far and he still can't reach it.
Well, I don't know if the hand of God respects Newton's third law or not. The early Christian workers talked about the unmoved mover, which was supposed to be God. So in that case, Newton's third law wouldn't apply. But short of God, everything we know of obeys Newton's third law. So as long as there's no external force. So if this guy turns on a jet pack and jets over to the other side of the boat, that's an external force. But as long as the only way he moves forward is by pushing back on the boat, then there's no external force. There's forces between him and the boat, but not an external force. The boat is going to move back.
Because he's putting force on the boat as he's walking.
Yep. So equal and opposite forces, every step he takes forward pushes the boat back. And the center of mass has to stay in the same spot.
Where did we get the x plus 2 and then the x plus 4? I get how the child moves 4 meters, but I don't understand the boat.
Yeah, so I don't know if the child moves 4 meters or not. What X is it's the location of this end of the boat. So that means that the kid is X plus 4.
Okay.
And the boat is X plus 2 because we're assuming that the center of mass is halfway through the boat.
Wouldn't it all be due to friction then? Because he wouldn't be able to walk forward without.
Well, so I'm talking about friction between the boat and the water. You're right. So in order to walk, there has to be... Well, actually, I'm not sure I believe that. The normal force could also do that by pushing off against something that's slanted. But we're talking about external forces. Whatever the force is between him and the boat, we don't care. So there could be strings or springs or anything that's connected between him and the boat. That's an internal force, and that's accounted for. So the hand of God, jetpacks, those things are ruled out. Then the center of mass can move. Right, if he turns on the boat's engine, for example, there will be an external force, and he could motor right up to that turtle. Right.
Okay.
Of course, the turtle's going to be ground into turtle soup by the propellers. But
what if they're on the opposite side of the boat?
Yeah, I'm just enjoying the blood. So.
I'm sorry.
In fact, the turtle would dive in. And so he'd put his hand in the water, and his hand would be chewed up by the propellers. More questions? Okay, so let's go back to kind of the more standard problems where we've got things like that. So actually, let's do this one, 22. So why this hungry bear is walking out to get these goodies, I don't know. But apparently he is, because it wouldn't be in the book otherwise. So we're told that we have this kind of funny setup where this angle is 60 degrees, and we've got 80 newtons of goodies, and we've got 200 newtons of bare, which doesn't, although that's the beam. We got 700 newtons of bare. That's still not a very big bare. And we've got a 200 newton beam, and we're supposed to figure out what the tension is basically in this string. Okay, so it's pretty much, I guess things are kind of reversed, but here are the goodies, here's the bear, here's the string. We're supposed to figure out what all of the forces are that are involved. Okay, so 6 meters long, and that means we can treat all of that mass at the center of gravity of the object, which it, since it's uniform, is going to be halfway through, and it weighs 200 newtons. The picnic basket, 80 newtons at the end, and we've got this string that is at 60 degrees, whose tension we don't know. And the bear is initially at 1 meter. Now, there are all sorts of forces that are occurring at this spot. So what we have is a normal force that's going to be pushing out, and we have a force that's going to be pushing vertically, right? So it has to be a force this way. Let me call that N. And we have to have some sort of support force. Let's call that F. Some of the forces have to be zero. Some of the torques have to be zero. You get to choose your origin for the torque. And this is similar enough that I think the two logical choices are going to be like there and there for the origin. Yeah, I don't know. Last class I chose that, so I'm going to choose this one for the origin this time. Better get the same answer. So let's first of all deal with the forces in the x direction. The only forces in the x direction are this normal force and this component of tension. That's the side that's adjacent to the 60 degrees. It's in the minus x direction, so it's going to be minus t cosine of 60 degrees. This normal force is 100% in the x direction. Those are the only forces in the x direction. So we've got a lot of weights that are going down. We've got the bear, we've got the plank, and we've got the goodies. All of those are forces down. We've got F that's in the positive direction, and we've got this piece of tension, which is T sine theta, sine of 60 degrees, that's in the positive y direction. So far we've got three unknowns, right? We don't know what N is, we don't know what T is, and we don't know what F is. And we only have two equations.
Does gravity not play a part in this one then?
This was gravity. These was all these weights.
Oh, the newtons are already.
They've already multiplied the mass times g to get a force.
Okay.
More questions? Okay, so if I choose this as my origin, there's no torque due to t, there's no torque due to the goodies. There's going to be a torque due to the plank and the bear and the force F. The plank and the bear, I hope it's clear, are all trying to twist it in the counterclockwise direction. Whereas F is trying to twist it in that direction. So there's no torque due to N because it's not trying to twist. It's all in the direction. It has no moment arm, I guess would be one way of saying it. This one is nicely perpendicular, so that's just going to be the force times the full 6 meters. And everything else is pretty much all lined up. So starting from this guy, we've got its force times its moment arm, which is 6. We've got the bear, negative, because it's trying to twist it. Oops, I lied. So my convention has been that counterclockwise is positive. So this is clockwise, so I should have called that negative. This guy is trying to twist it clockwise. So it's 5 meters away, and the bear weighs 700 newtons. The center of mass of the rod is 3 meters away, and it weighs 200 newtons. The goodies and the tension don't matter, so the sum of those torques have to be equal to 0. And I get kind of an immediate solution then for this unknown force F. So I've got 5 times 700 plus 3 times 200 is equal to F times 6. So the force is going to be that same numerator. So 700 times 5. And 600 all divided by 6, I get 683 newtons.
Where did you get the
3 from that you want? So that has to be the distance that the center of mass of the plank is from my origin. So the whole plank is 6, and the center of mass is halfway, so we got 3 meters. So once I've got F, I can use this equation to give me T. So if I put everything except T on the other side of the equation, I'm going to have T times the sine of 60 degrees is equal to minus F plus all of this stuff, which is all the weight of the bear, the plank, and the goodies. So T is equal to that same numerator divided by the sine of 60 degrees. I still got my 683 sitting there. So 7 plus 200 plus 80 is 980. And I want to subtract that 680 from it and then divide by the sine of 60 degrees. And I get 343. Yep. Once I've got T, I can get N. Right? Because N is equal to T times the cosine of 60 degrees. So I've got T sitting here, just need to multiply it by the cosine of 60 degrees, and I get 171.
Why is the F for the second equation negative?
Say again?
Why is the F negative?
So this is the original equation. So I've moved that F to this side of the equation. So this stuff was all negative on this side of the equation, so it came over as positive.
And in this case, how come the center of, or you know, like the center of mass, or how come it's not directly below the wheel, like the anchor support thing? Like how come it's right in the middle of this board?
So for a uniform rod, yep, the center of mass is going to be in the center. Well, so in some sense, the boy and the boat, if we wanted to, we could have calculated the center of mass of those two guys. We never actually divided by the mass to get the actual location of the center of mass, but we could have done that. So something that's not uniform, this thing is designed to look uniform, but it's not. There's a lead weight here. So the center of mass is someplace over here. For this thing here, which is obviously not uniform, the center of mass is going to be about there.
the center of mass wouldn't be right in the middle because there's an uneven force on the end?
Hmm. This end?
It's going to be, the center is going to be closer to that end, won't it? Well, not center of mass, sorry. I'm thinking of center of gravity.
Same thing.
It still would be the center?
Yeah, so the center of mass of this, of any uniform thing is going to be halfway, because that's where it would balance, right?
Okay, yeah.
So this is kind of a tricky situation if you think about it. So this is a cantilever where there's no like string to support it. And if you think about what must be happening at this little point, is there must be a big force that's pushing it up here and a little force that's pushing it up there to provide a torque that's countering the torque of gravity, which is trying to twist it. So there are actually really big forces that have to act here because there's a very small distance in order to account for this big torque here. And this is often how the human body works, where you have muscle attachments that are relatively close, so you end up having relatively big forces in order to fight what are only moderately sized forces. Yep, so we can say that the force of gravity acts here with the total weight of this bar. And there have to be forces like this, this one being a little bit bigger than this one, because the sum of the forces have to be zero, but these guys have to be super big in order to have a torque that's fighting this torque of gravity. More questions? Now, how about some iQuiz questions? These are more iQuiz questions from gravity sort of situations. I don't know if we have time for that. We got time for this one, I guess. Okay, so here we've got one of these elliptical orbits, and we've got three locations marked on this orbit. Right, so this is going to be perigee, that's apogee, this is halfway around, and D is none of the above. And we have questions like, where is the potential energy least, etc. So, choosing among these positions, where is the potential energy the least? Just see two cards and it's 50-50. Now it's gone the wrong way. Still 50-50. So I'm seeing A's and C's. So the least potential energy is going to be with the least height. And C is obviously lower than A. Now, you might be confused because all of these are negative numbers. So C might be minus 10 and A might be minus 5, but C is still less than A. Less potential energy at C than A. Where is the speed the least? So, disagreement. So, remember there's this kind of balance of potential energy and kinetic energy. At C, we have not much potential energy, so we have to have lots of kinetic energy. At A, we have to have lots of potential energy, so we don't have much kinetic energy. So the slowest spot will be the highest spot, which is A. So we haven't talked about angular momentum yet. Where is the angular speed the least? Where is omega the least? I don't like C. Yeah, I like A. I like A, right? So here's the equation. So big R means small omega. So A is going to have the least angular velocity. How about the acceleration? Where is the acceleration the least? Only over there. Over here it's still, it's like in the legislature where they stop the clock 1 minute before it's ending. So, yeah. So the acceleration is the force of gravity, right? So the farther you are away from the planet, the smaller the force of gravity, the smaller the acceleration. So A has the least acceleration. So don't forget the quiz on statics. We'll vote on a help session. My guess is that if it works out like last time, it'll end up be Tuesday night. So let's just think about it. So which one does the Coke can or the calculator have more potential energy?
Coke can.
Yeah, because it's higher. So A is higher, so it's going to have more potential energy.
How is A higher? Like, what do you mean by that?
So higher is distance from the center of the Earth.
Is it the big dot or sun?
Sun, whatever, the planet, the big dot in the center. Well, but sideways is meaningless, right, to God, right? So you can put it like that. It's the same story. So on the South Pole, if I hold these things up, the Coke can still has more potential energy than the calculator. So the quiz will be on statics, this sort of stuff that we've been doing.